inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to The Core here on American Family Radio. Walker Wildman here live with you on this edition of the program. And a lot to talk about in the news, in the culture, and we attempt to do all of it from a biblical perspective, from a Christian perspective. So that's what we're going to do here on the program today. Psalm 132 is where we are this week. And I want to point out verse 13. For the Lord has chosen Zion, he has desired it for his habitation. That's verse 13 in Psalm 132. And it's amazing that we see even today some, 4,000 or 5,000 years later, we see the significance of Israel and the land of the Bible being displayed in front of our very eyes. It's amazing how that works. And as I've mentioned before, if you miss out on the spiritual dynamic of the Jewish people and the land of Israel, none of it makes sense. None of it makes sense when you try to cover the hatred for the Jewish people through a non-biblical lens. It really doesn't make sense at all. And it's nearly comical watching the world, watching the unbelieving world try to, dance around the Israel situation and the hatred for Israel and do so without citing the Bible or talking about anything spiritual. So that's Psalm 132, verse 13. For the Lord has chosen Zion, he has desired it for his habitation. Well, we have an election 3 weeks away, 3 weeks tomorrow. We'll actually mark the day. And a lot can happen in 3 weeks. So I want to encourage voters, don't sit on your hands. Don't say, I've done my part. Folks, vote, vote, vote. That's what I've been saying. And if you've already voted through the early voting process, then make sure you get plenty of others out to vote on Election Day or before. And this is our civic duty. This is our responsibility. And this is really a stewardship discussion. It is. It's a stewardship discussion. And when people want to make excuses for not being engaged civically, they're making arguments really in favor of poor stewardship. All right? So the reality is that God allows us to be stewards over a variety of things and people during our time on this earth. Everyone's stewardship reach and principle looks a little bit different depending on what the Lord has entrusted to you. But in the context of government, which is an institution created by God, by the way, there's nothing secular about government. Let's remember that. When you try to secularize politics, you can't do it with honesty because God created government. And I'm talking to the Christian community out there. I'm talking to believers. When you try to make an argument that politics is a dirty business, politics is the world's game, and I don't want to be involved in it, and what difference does it make? You are completely ignoring the fact that government was created by God and has a specific purpose. And is politics a dirty business? Well, yeah, but it's we're living in a sinful world. So, what part of operating in a fallen world doesn't have its negative aspects from time to time. All right, it's quote-unquote dirty side, right? Whatever that means, by the way. Because if you're trying to say that there are sinners involved in politics, well, that would be a fact. Just like there are sinners involved in church life, that would be a fact. Just like there are sinners and unbelievers that are in the business world, that would be a fact. And so trying to single out the political realm, the civic realm, as if it's this unusually dirty realm that Christians ought not be involved in, is a complete hoax. And furthermore, God created it. God created government to be a force for good and to punish the evildoer. That's the essence of what Scripture says. Now, is government the church? Of course not. And I actually don't know any level-headed Christians who is claiming such. God created three institutions. He created the family. He created government. And he created the church. And they each have their own distinctive role. But in this land that we live in, we've been blessed with the opportunity to be able to pick our leaders, which is actually a privilege and an ability that not all people groups throughout human history have gotten to do. So we can go back to the days of kings and dictators, and 70, 80% of the world lives under that currently. Maybe not that much, but the world still lives under dictatorships and kings. And if you look around the world, some of the most human suffering happens under leaderships and structures that are not biblical. I'm talking about government structures, right? And so we don't need to, in America, we don't need to become poor stewards of that which God has entrusted to us. I'm talking about how our government is set up. We don't need to be poor stewards of it. And furthermore, we don't need to squander that which generations before us have fought, bled, and died for so that we could experience some form of liberty and freedom and a just society. We don't need to squander it. So it's purely a stewardship topic when we're talking about elections and civic engagement. And the same thing applies to every other aspect of the life of the believer. It's all about stewardship. And what you find is when believers take stewardship seriously, then that folks, that overflows into all aspects of life. All right? It's not just money. It's not just voting. All aspects of life, how we spend our time, how we disciple people around us, how we treat people, how we handle our money, how we take care of things and individuals around us, all of this is a stewardship discussion. And we need to be found good stewards. So that's my challenge for you as we head towards this election. And there are elections other than president, right? Let's don't forget that. There's elections all the way up and down the ballot, all the way from mayor, city council, governor, Senate, House, state offices all around the country. So I know the presidential race is the one getting the most headlines, but folks, there's elections all up and down the ballot. For all things you need regarding the election, iVoterGuide.com is where you find the information, iVoterGuide.com. All right, jumping into a topic in the last few minutes we have left of the segment, I want to play a clip here. This is clip two, and this is Kamala Harris. Remember, the White House, on one hand, has said that there's no daylight between Biden and Harris when it comes to policies. But at the same time, Kamala Harris is doing stump speeches around the country saying we need to turn the page. That's a direct quote from Kamala Harris. We need to turn the page when it comes to American leadership and move on to bigger and greater and more joyful things. Well, here is Kamala Harris on The View saying that her and Biden, I mean, there's completely no difference here. Clip two.
If anything, would you have done something differently than President Biden during the past 4 years?
There is not a thing that comes to mind in terms of, and I've been a part of most of the decisions that have had impact.
Would you do anything different over the last 4 years compared to what Biden has done? And Kamala Harris just answers the question. She says, you know, there's not anything that I can think of that I would do different. So Kamala Harris is doing one speech on The View saying, I wouldn't do anything different. I mean, if I could go back, we'd go through it all again. Inflation, war, illegal immigration, abortion. But then she's going out doing speeches saying we need to turn the page. Turn the page from what? You're the one that's been in charge. And this is, folks, this is the dilemma. Like, capital T, capital H, capital E. This is the dilemma. And there are many dilemmas out there, lowercase. But this is the dilemma. When you swap out the candidate for with one of the major political parties, when you swap them out in the third quarter, this is what happens. Okay, so Kamala Harris, hear me out. Kamala Harris, the vice president, had Biden pre-primary 2 years ago said, or even 18 months ago, said, look, it's been a great, you know, first term. I've been in politics since the 1700s, and it's time for new leadership, for fresh young leadership. And so I'm going to bow out. I'm going to resign effective at the end of my term. I've done my part, and it's time for the Democrat Party and the voters to choose who they want to lead the party into the future. And then, of course, he could endorse Kamala Harris or however they want to work that out. But nonetheless, they could actually have a primary process where the voters actually get a say on who's running to be presidential nominee for the Democrats. And then that way, Kamala Harris, with at least like 50% sense of integrity and honesty, could say that we're going to turn the page. We're going for new, fresh, young leadership. And then, you know, when asked about Biden, she could say, you know, I think Biden's been a good president. There may be some things I would do differently, but I wasn't the commander in chief. I was the vice president, so I was there to serve the president. But look, it's enough of the past. Let's talk about the future. Here's my vision for America over the next 4 to 8 years. And she might be able to halfway squeeze out of that, okay? But with this current setup, there's no room for error. There is nowhere to go. She owns the Biden administration. Because Biden crowned her, the voters didn't crown her. The party leaders crowned her. The grassroots did not crown her. And you can't throw your boss, your current boss, under the bus while you're trying to get elected with an electorate, by the way, amongst the Democrats, that over 60% said they wanted Biden as of 3 months ago. Okay, so this isn't as if Biden is woefully unpopular amongst Democrat voters, because that's not true. That's crazy. I know that Biden is popular amongst Democrat voters, but he is. That's a hard reality. And going into this whole election shenanigan of swapping out Harris for Biden, or Biden for Harris, even up until the weeks leading up to it, the switcheroo, right? Over 60% of Democrat voters said they liked Biden. They wanted him to be the nominee. They were all in for Biden. And so that's why Kamala Harris can't throw Biden under the bus at this juncture. Because there's some Biden loyal voters out there that Kamala Harris needs to put her over the finish line. But the last 4 years have been an unmitigated disaster. And Kamala Harris is trying to balance that out as well.
You know, there are many ways we can impact the world around us. Some are more direct, like helping our neighbors and serving in our churches. Other ways are broad, like becoming community leaders or supporting missions. Of course, taking care of our families is a given. If there was a way to impact all of those at once, would you be interested? The AFA Foundation is a great way to touch your family, your neighbors, and even complete strangers all over the country. You may not realize it, but you can support AFA with a charitable gift annuity, a trust, your will, or a charitable rollover. We realize not everyone knows what those are or how to set them up, but that's okay. Many of your questions can be answered on our website, afafoundation.net. Find answers and resources to help you make an informed decision, and if your decision is to move forward, you can get in touch with Riley, Chelsea, or Jessica to start setting up your legacy. Touch more lives than you imagined possible when you visit afafoundation.net today.
At the Core podcasts are available at afr.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to The Core here on American Family Radio. Glad to have you with us today on the program. Our podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. We have the podcast published on all the major podcast platforms, whether you have an Apple device, Android, Roku, Spotify, the list goes on. The podcast is available. Just type in the name of the show At The Core and click the subscribe button, and the show will be queued up in your podcast library each and every day when we upload it in the afternoon. So do that so you don't miss the show, you don't miss a segment on the program. Well, we do have a guest to continue our discussion of stewardship and elections and government. We have on with us Richard Nelson. He's founder and executive director of the Commonwealth Policy Center there in the state of Kentucky. He's also author of the book Christianity and Politics, very fitting topic for our discussion today. Richard, welcome to the program.
Hey, Walker, it's great to be on with you today.
Well, I've been checking out your book, Richard, and it fits well with the season that we're in our country. The title of the book is Christianity and Politics. It's a memoir of spiritual formation and a field guide for Christians in the public arena. Very, very fitting. Give us a little, before we jump into the specifics of the book, give us a little overview. What led you to write it?
Yeah, well, first of all, I've been involved in the public arena, engaging politics and policy from a biblical worldview for almost 30 years. And I wanted to share the lessons I learned, Walker, with other Christians who are interested in influencing the public debates of the day, or even running for office. A lot of what I share in the book is trial and error, man. I've learned the wrong way to do things. And I found that, man, when we lean into God's word and when we apply his word to our lives, it's powerful. And I think we as Christians know that it's powerful, but sometimes we've got to learn the hard way, doing it on our own and not necessarily applying it to our lives. And when I've done that, I've seen some amazing things, and I share stories in here of just how we can honor God. And that was one of my other goals, Walker, was to help other believers who want to influence the public arena to the glory of God. Mm-hmm. And let's be frank, we live in challenging times. The issues we're dealing with today are nothing like I had imagined even 10 years ago. So many issues. I know your listeners are aware of them. You talk about these issues on the program all the time. But we've got to get our heads on straight as Christians, realizing that, you know, secular people are going to sin. They're going to resort to doing things their way, which is not God's way. And we have a better way. We have God's guidebook in life, his guidebook as far as what healthy society looks like, what a healthy government looks like. And these are some of the things I try to drill down on in my book.
Let me ask you this, Richard. What kind of, I know you have to address kind of some of the counter arguments to civic engagement from a biblical perspective, because they're out there, right? I mean, I rattled some off in the first segment, and we all hear, when we talk to people, you hear the, you know, there's probably a handful, probably four or five common excuses to disengaging from culture and government. But what seems to be the most common excuse that you hear out there of reasons people don't want to vote, they don't really want to talk about government stuff and politics?
Yeah, there's a couple that I share in my book. One is separation of church and state. Well, you know, keep your values to yourself. Christians, it's okay if you believe what you believe on Sunday mornings, but just don't try to take it to the voting booth with you on Tuesday. And that whole idea is, it's still with us in the church today. That idea was introduced by our founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson, who wrote a letter to the Danbury Baptist Association. They were concerned about the government entangling itself in church affairs. And Jefferson said, look, there is a wall of separation between the federal government and the church. No need to worry about that. That was a restriction on the government, by the way.
Yes.
What Jefferson was saying in that letter was it did not impede or restrict the church from influencing government. And we have totally forgotten that. Walker, another common objection I hear is don't impose your morality on other people, or you can't legislate morality. Well, here's the bottom line. We all laws have some form of morality undergirding it, right? It's just a question of whose morality will inform the public policy of the day. And today we have a secular, humanistic, and quite frankly, a destructive morality worldview that undergirds many of the policies. And I think, for example, probably one of the best examples is this idea that young people should be able to determine their own gender identity and just say, hey, if there's a young boy that identifies as a female, let them choose to pursue that lifestyle. Let them pursue hormone therapy or transition surgery. This is something that as Christians, we cannot stand by and say, that's okay, or I don't want to impose my morality on somebody else. No, we say kids can't make decisions like that. They shouldn't. We should stand in the gap for them. They don't know better. They're vulnerable, but we should stand in the gap and speak on their behalf for their bodily integrity, for their mental health, and try to help them from making a bad decision that they're going to regret the rest of their lives. So these are a couple of the objections. A couple of objections that I hear. Walker, I was with a pastor last night. We did a Q&A at a church in far west Kentucky. And we talked about what is one of the biggest changes that we've seen in the political arena over the last 20, 25 years or so. And it's that the church, many people in the church are looking for answers. They want to know how to engage, how to think about the issues, how to think about candidates who are on the ballot. But unfortunately, many people in the church have not been discipled by pastors because pastors have refused to speak to the issues of the day, speak to our relationship as Christians to government. And quite frankly, many people in the body of Christ in this country today have been discipled not by pastors or by church leaders, but they've been discipled by the world, by partisans, by talking heads, by others who don't necessarily have a biblical worldview. And the church is wondering, hey, how do we think about these issues? Where do we begin to engage? What should we do? That kind of thing. And this is a call to action for pastors today. Pastors, if you're reluctant to speak to the issues, if you're afraid to speak to when the Bible speaks to moral issues, when it speaks to the proper role of government, then please be willing to speak to that. When the Bible speaks on something, we should speak on something clearly, willing to disciple God's people. When we fail to do that, we're going to see the culture and other influencers in society discipling the church.
Yeah, and one thing I've noticed is there's this you mentioned it about the argument of like, don't place your morals on me, that type of kind of libertarian mindset. But That also, it carries, I think there's some fear. Let me just say this. I think there's some fear amongst well-meaning Christians as far as the logical conclusion of Christians ought to be involved in government. And what I mean by that is they don't want to have to answer the tough questions about, okay, so if we get to do it your way, the biblical way, then what does that mean for our laws? Meaning what's permissible and not permissible, whether you're talking about a marriage, abortion, stealing. I mean, there's all kinds of moral issues under the scripture that we could talk about. But there's that fear of like stating that there ought to be disincentives and laws that guide our behavior, right? Because that's what laws are for, is to either incentivize behavior or disincentivize behavior. Yeah. But they don't want to have to get into that kind of the weeds of it, because then they're going to have to make definitive statements about right and wrong. And that's kind of uncomfortable territory for some people.
You know, God gives us guardrails in life. If you read the word, if you've been involved with church for any amount of time, you see that God gives us these guardrails of life. The ancient Israelites were kind of like the model civilization. They were a picture of God's redemptive power through history, but they were given certain rules. We're given certain moral rules today. And Walker, it's not because God is hard or he wants to make our life tough, but it's because he loves us and he doesn't want us to hurt ourselves. And we go outside of those guardrails, man, it doesn't end well. Mm-hmm. And as Christians, we should care about our neighbors. We should care about those who we don't want to see people hurt themselves. And so as we engage the public arena, we're working for policies, and we should look at policies from a biblical grid that benefits all of us, whether or not you're a Christian. We believe that, for example, kids, young girls and boys deserve to have a mother and a father raising them. Hmm. We believe that children should not be indoctrinated in public schools with radical gender ideology that tells them that they can choose whatever gender that they feel like on that day, that their gender is fluid. No, those are harmful, destructive policies, and we should find our voice when it comes to those things. Why? Because when it honors God, it benefits our neighbors. This is the way we love our neighbors, and we want people to flourish. We want our society to do well. The further we move away from God and his guardrails, the more likely we are to get into trouble. We're more likely to hurt ourselves, and society ends up, we all suffer.
Yeah.
Right? If you look at the statistics today, by the way, we're not doing very well as a society. Suicide rates in about a 20-year time period have increased by 30-some%. When you look at the mental health of people in this country, somewhere between 10 to 15% are on some kind of antidepressant. Our mental health, loneliness has been considered an epidemic, I believe, by the CDC. We're not doing well as a people. And how can this be? We're in the wealthiest, most prosperous, freest nation on the face of the earth. What has gone wrong? Well, I would submit to you, we've lost our moral compass. We've rejected those guardrails that God has given us, and we're suffering for it.
Mm. Amen. We're talking to Richard Nelson, founder and executive of the Commonwealth Policy Center there in Kentucky, and his book is Christianity and Politics, which we're talking about now. Richard, what are you seeing? I talk about this battle that we're in for righteousness in America in this context. I talk about it as a long-term generational fight, because America didn't get to where she is now over the course of 3 or 4 years. This is a 40, 50, some would argue longer than that, 100-year battle against bad ideas in America. And we've lost on many fronts. We've won some battles, but we've lost on many fronts. What would you say to those who get discouraged because, you know, one thing doesn't go the way they think it should when you're talking about elections or having righteous rulers? How would you encourage our audience on that?
Yeah, you know, discouragement is part of the political equation, right? We work hard for candidates. We try to convince our friends and neighbors and Sunday school class members to vote a certain way or to support a certain policy. And having defeats and losses, that's just part of the arena that we're in. Where we need to find our confidence is in the living God, that he is sovereign over all. He raises up kings. He removes kings. That's what Daniel 2:21 says. And he, whatever the result will be this November the 5th is election day, whatever the result will be, God's not going to be caught off guard. Mm. God can even raise up unrighteous people. I don't want to see unrighteous people govern, but he does that in his sovereign reign over history. We've seen him do it all throughout history. And as Christians, we need to go back to the drawing board and recalibrate and say, okay, Lord, the election is over. I can't do anything about this from here on out. Please have mercy on us. I pray for this leader who might be in office now. May you guide their heart and move them in a direction that's honoring to you. But what we need to do is we need to increase our faith. We need to be in prayer. We need to realize that God is just as much is in control of the world affairs the day before the election as the day after the election, and continue to be engaged. See him work, see his hand at work, and then ask him, Lord, how can you work through me? What can you do? Didn't turn out the way I wanted it to. Don't agree with this person and their policies. But Lord, this has not caught you off guard. You were still on your throne. But what can I do to further your kingdom in whatever sphere of influence that I have?
Yeah, absolutely. Two things can be true at the same time. God's sovereignty is true, and our responsibility as believers to live godly lives and be good stewards. That's simultaneously true at the same time. And the two work very well together, not against each other. Richard, thanks so much for coming on the program. And tell our folks where they can get the book.
Yeah, Christianity and Politics, a Memoir of Spiritual Formation and Field Guide to Christians in the Public Arena, can be found on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. We have it on different forms as well. There's an audiobook, and it's on Google Reader as well, so you can check it out there. Go to Amazon to find Christianity and Politics.
All right. Thanks so much, Richard. Appreciate you coming on.
All right. Thank you. God bless you.
All right. That's Richard Nelson, author of Christianity and Politics. And folks, the case is pretty straightforward. It's pretty simple. The biblical case for stewarding your vote and being involved in who our leaders are, because somebody's going to rule, right? Human history has shown that somebody's going to rule. Somebody's going to reign over people. And the reality is if believers, if the salt and light disengage from that process, what happens? Pagans and the unbelieving world fill the void. And when the unbelieving world fills the power void of government, very bad things happen. Let me just put it that way. Look, read your history books. Read the Bible. First and foremost is a primary history book about what happens when ungodly leaders get in positions of power and authority. What happens? People suffer. People suffer. And so as believers, we ought not desire for humanity to suffer. We ought to desire for humans to flourish, for the gospel to flourish, for discipleship to flourish, and to be good stewards of that which God has entrusted to us. So let's choose righteous leaders. Leaders with integrity, with the best interest of our nation at heart, and then leave the results up to God. We'll be back in a few. You've heard a lot about saving babies on this show. That's because it's important to me personally. And let me just be frank with you. We need to save them. That is why we have partnered with Preborn, the nation's leader in introducing mothers with unplanned pregnancies to their babies. And once she hears the heartbeat and sees that precious life growing inside of her, she is twice as likely to choose life. Now that's a miracle. But quite honestly, if we don't save them, who will? Preborn receives no government funding, so their work is completely dependent on us. Preborn has rescued over 280,000 babies, and that's not all. They provide love, support, and counseling for up to 2 years for free, saving lives and souls. One ultrasound is just $28. Or 140 helps rescue 5 babies' lives. Abortion doesn't stop, so we can't. Together, you and I can save lives. Just call #250 on your cell and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio with your host, Walker Wildman.
Welcome back to the Core here on American Family Radio. This is our last segment, and we've got a great interview lined up. You won't want to miss it. You actually probably want to share it with your family and friends. We have on with us Ryan Kleckner. He's a businessman, attorney, and an author. And he's with us now to talk about the overreach of the federal government and some of the specific agencies within the purview of the executive branch. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, Ryan, one of my colleagues put me on to one of your speeches that you did for Hillsdale when you were at their Blake Center for Faith and Freedom in the state of Connecticut back in July of this past year. And it was really fascinating just reading your speech and some of the areas that you talked about as far as government overreach at the federal level. And this has been a major issue and really a major theme of the Biden administration is how these agencies, these federal agencies, are being weaponized against conservatives and Christians. And there's just example after example after example, starting with the January 6th issue and those that are still imprisoned by Biden and the DOJ and haven't had a fair and speedy trial. That's probably could do a whole show on that. But give us a little bit about your backgrounder and what put you onto this issue.
Well, I'm an attorney a little bit. That's how I like to describe it to people when they ask what I do is because you're right. I have a bunch of things I do. And when I am an attorney, what I do is I represent the firearms industry against the ATF. So I don't represent individuals. I represent manufacturers, dealers, distributors, things like that. And I help them navigate the myriad ATF rules that come up every year and the regulations that get changed all the time and the federal firearms laws. And it's actually pretty darn complicated. And with the increased enforcement of these laws, you know, the Biden administration calls it the no tolerance policy or the zero tolerance policy. What they're doing is they are trying to shut down FFLs. An FFL is a licensee. That's the person that's the gun store or the gun dealer. That's the license they get from the ATF to conduct business. They're shutting them down over typos. You know, there's always been issues if there's typos or issues if a form wasn't checked in the right box, but really it was a good transaction. And now under the zero tolerance policy, they're just coming down and revoking FFLs, which is putting, you know, families sometimes and many employees out of business. They're criminally prosecuting people. And in my example in the speech that you saw, they're killing American citizens over technicalities in the licensing system.
Yeah, talk about that specifically because that sounds crazy, right? The federal government killing citizens, but you've got a case. The one I'm thinking of is from Little Rock, from Arkansas, and there may be others. There probably are others, historically speaking. But talk about some of those cases and how simple process errors lead to raids, and people end up dying.
For sure, it's not only these simple process errors. You're right, but it's also these fat gray lines that are really hard for people to determine whether they're even complying within the law or not. And that's what happened here to Mr. Brian Malinowski in Little Rock, Arkansas. He was the director of the Little Rock Airport. And as a side hobby, he would attend gun shows. In addition to collecting guns, he also collected coins and bought and sold those as well. But he'd go to gun shows and he would buy or sell various firearms as he saw fit. And the ATF had determined that he crossed this imaginary line over which it's changed from a hobby to being a business and therefore requiring a license. Now, the ATF doesn't have a bright line. They don't say this many guns in this period or this amount of money or any other standard. Instead, they say, if you're engaged in the business, if it's not a hobby, well, what does engaged in the business mean? Well, part of the problem with engaged in the business is they tried to define it in a new law that was coming out after Brian Malinowski was killed. So the law hadn't even gone into effect yet, but they tried to define it in that law that said a principal objective of livelihood and profit. Well, even if that law applied at the time, which it didn't, he was the director for the airport. He was the highest paid city employee. That was clearly his career. That was his livelihood. That was his principal livelihood. This was clearly on the side. And they pointed out that he had bought over 100 firearms. He had purchased over 100 firearms in the previous 3 years. But what I've seen from the ATF is he only sold a few of them. So that sounds like he's actually building a big collection to me, and he's not going back and forth. Regardless, the ATF decided that he crossed this gray line. And they said, you know what? He's engaged in the business, so he needs to have a license. So what did they do? Did they contact him? Hey, Mr. Malinowski, we're the ATF. We see you've been buying and selling a lot of guns. We really think you should get a license. Did they send him a letter? Did they call him? Did they approach him at the gun shows? Well, they sure approached him at the gun shows. They put multiple undercover ATF agents at the gun shows to go up to him to try and get him to do something to get him in trouble. Didn't warn him, hey, just get the license. And by the way, guys, this license, there's about 100,000 FFLs in the country right now. Most of them are based out of their own home. They're not even retail storefronts. Mm-hmm. This license is about $65 a year is what it works out to be. And this license would have given Brian Malinowski the chance to buy guns at dealer prices, so it get him a lot cheaper, would have been able to clearly be engaged in the business and do a whole lot more things. This license would have probably been a really good thing for him to get. So it wasn't like he was trying to avoid it for some reason. But yet, the ATF, after realizing that they decided, not realizing, the deciding that he needed a license, the undercover agents didn't contact him. They put a GPS tracker on his car and tailed him around town. And they ended up getting a search warrant for his home. And they showed up, big show of force, showed up at his private residence with a search warrant, and he wasn't there. Well, I think that's the best time to probably do a search warrant if you're worried about firearms being involved.
Yeah.
Because if the person's not there, there can't be a problem. But they didn't want that. And this is my speculation, but to me, it seems like they wanted the conflict because they left and said, never mind, we'll come back when he's here. And they waited, and then later, days later, when he was home, they came at 6 o'clock in the morning with 10 vehicles. So part ATF agents, part Little Rock police. And the ATF and Little Rock police both have policies. They're supposed to have body cameras on at all times. Mm-hmm. Not a single body camera was turned on. They were all turned off or completely removed on every single person filling these 10 vehicles. And the only camera that recorded any of this was Mr. Malinowski's Ring camera, and all it recorded was the ATF coming up and putting a piece of tape over the camera before they raided his home. And about a minute later, after they put the tape over his camera, he was shot in the head and killed by the ATF. Now, that could have been de-escalated numerous ways that I've already mentioned, by contacting him, by talking to him about it, by sending him a letter, by doing the search warrant when he wasn't there. And I don't know what happened in that minute. The ATF says he shot at them first. I believe that's likely. His power was cut to his house and his door was bashed down with his Ring camera covered at 6 a.m.
Yeah, what do you expect? Right.
But this was an escalation at every turn. And I think it did what it was supposed to do. I think it sent a chilling effect across the rest of us as we even talk about this and imagine, oh no, what would happen to us if that was our home?
Yeah, it's in many of these cases, it's like the feds want, like, they want you to be a criminal. They're not suspecting that you are based on factual evidence. It's like they want to find something there that's not, and so that leads them to do things that are very irrational. And I'm not a big fan of the no-knock warrants. I understand the purpose of them, but that's just a recipe for disaster. Because you burst up in someone's home in the wee hours in the morning, and what is an armed homeowner gonna do when someone busts down their door at 4 or 5 a.m? What do you expect them to do? You expect them to roll over and put their hands up? No, they think they're being intruded, so they're gonna defend their home. That's a natural instinct. And so I hate it for these people that get these no-knock warrants at their homes in the wee hours of the morning, especially when they're innocent. Let me ask you this. Once again, we're talking to Ryan Klickner, who is an author and attorney. By the way, I didn't mention this. He's a former Army Ranger, sniper, and instructor. Ryan, in your professional opinion, and I'm not sure how much you can speak to this being an attorney who actually represents clients, but these federal agencies, specifically the ATF, for example, to talk specifics, do you think they ought to even exist, both constitutionally and like, give me your opinion if you can, to the degree that you can, legitimacy and the purpose of these agencies and whether they are retrievable or not.
So like a true lawyer, I might talk out both sides of my mouth here. It's really easy for me to say they should all be disbanded, that we have corruption among the ranks. We have such a problem that we can't vote it out of office. We have such a problem that we can't do it with just replacing one or two figureheads. I think there are good people in these agencies, but there's clearly not enough to stop these things from happening. And if we haven't crossed the line yet to where we're having situations happen like I just described, then what in anyone's mind that's listening would be the line when it's crossed that we need to get rid of them? So I have jokingly said before that if we have a a Trump victory, I would absolutely love to run the ATF and try to shut it down within 6 months.
Yeah.
Because I want to get rid of all this. Now, let me say the other side now. Law enforcement serves a valuable purpose for our society.
Yep.
We do need a regulator for some of these industries, because I believe no matter where we draw the line on gun control, we all could agree on maybe one or two people that we know of or have heard of that we wouldn't want to have access to firearms. We probably don't want firearms in jails, for example. Okay. We know certain people we don't have guns. So if we believe in that, then we need to find a way to enforce that. And if we have get rid of the ATF, then what are we going to replace it with? When I used to work for the Trade Association for the firearms industry, we actually argued on Capitol Hill, this was years past, about helping fund the ATF. And we had congressmen shocked that the Trade Association would want to fund them. And we explained, you get rid of the ATF, who's going to regulate the firearms industry? The FBI? That might be worse. You know, maybe they're not going to look at us as a regulated industry partner, and now they're going to look at everyone as a suspect, you know, even in the industry. So, yes, I want to clean house. I want to start over. But I can't be naive enough to say I would snap my fingers and all the federal agencies gone.
Yeah.
Because we do have some things we need to do.
Yeah, I agree completely. And that's the same way I feel about people who are talking about just shutting down the FBI. It sounds great, right? And everybody gets excited about it. But in practicality, that's just not going to happen, right? You can severely sever it and make it not what it is today. And I think that's probably the way to go. But closing it down in 24 hours just isn't going to happen. There's too many functions that are going on there. But wouldn't you agree, Ryan, that some of this stuff could be relegated to the states with clear laws on the books? Some of this stuff could be, I'm thinking about the FBI, some of this stuff could be handled at the state and local level.
You're exactly right. It could be handled at the state and local level. And also a point that you may be making a little bit here too, is by giving the states more power, I think we remove some of the power from the executive.
Yeah.
The problem with these federal agencies that are out of control isn't necessarily the agencies, it's their boss. Mm-hmm. If this was a business, if this is any other business, you had employees that were horrible customer service, or they were stealing products, they were doing, you would look to the leadership of the management and wondering why they were allowed to get away with this. Well, all these federal agencies are this extension of the executive branch, and I think we are way out of control with way too much power. These people making these decisions, they're unelected bureaucrats, the professional bureaucrats that have no accountability to the American populace through any sort of democratic vote to say if we want them in power or not. And I think by removing some of the power from the executive, by giving it fine to the states, that's okay. I'm fine with that. We need to have somehow to make the states agree, right? You know, we get rid of the FAA and leave all air traffic control to the states. Well, pilots are going to have problems as they're jumping from state to state if they have different standards. But taking it out of the centralized power that it is now, I think would be good for everyone.
Yeah, and if you do that, you are going to need more clear federal laws, like none of this gray line business or the examples you described of what is a dealer, who needs a license and who doesn't. Like, come on, this is not rocket science. Like, write clear laws. And if you don't like
how— Well, I'm blaming Congress on this one.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, 100%. Yeah, Congress, they're the— If you had to blame one person or one entity, it's Congress, because they allow agencies like the ATF to be out of control. They're comfortable with it because they can just blame, well, it's, you know, the president appointed the director and we can't do anything about it. Well, that's not true. Their primary role is oversight and accountability. So
they could take the funding away. So not only do they have oversight, the problem, I'm sure we probably agree on this one, the problem with oversight is they can bang the table and say, we're mad at what you're doing.
True.
Yeah. But if, you know, they don't have— You know, it's said of the Supreme Court, they have, you know, neither the sword nor the purse. You know, I think Congress has the purse.
Yes.
They need to be able to use that and say things like, hey, you're not doing what we're supposed to be doing. We're not going to fund this.
100%.
Or I hear pity. Congress says we're the ones that make the laws. We're supposed to be making the laws. Good. Then make the laws.
Yes.
Then make it clear, because the federal firearms laws we're dealing with now are the Gun Control Act of 1968 and the National Firearms Act of 1934. That's it. 1968. Now, I'm not a fan of more laws. If anything, whenever I hear of the government being bogged down, I smile a little bit. I like a bit of an inefficient government. I don't like things changing. I like things taking their time. But we're dealing with laws that don't handle the industry the way it is now. And so the ATF is just making up these, they call them rules, just ATF rule. And it's essentially a regulation, and it's a law by fiat. I don't like it.
Yeah, exactly. 100%. Yeah, Congress needs to clarify, and we need less rules on the books. And we really don't need any rules because they're carrying the effect of law, and they shouldn't. That's not how it should work.
Agreed.
Congress passes laws. Hey, Ryan, tell our folks your website real quick. We got 15 seconds.
Please check me out at RyanKlechner.com or pay attention to gun stuff at GunUniversity.com. Those are both mine.
All right, Ryan Klechner. Hey, Ryan, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. That's Ryan Klechner, C-L-E-C-K-N-E-R, RyanKlechner.com. We'll post a link on the show notes wherever you find your podcast. We'll see you next time.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.